So, members, it is 1 p.m. and I call this meeting to order. And with that said, may I have a motion to approve the March 11th, 2026 minutes?
Motion.
So moved. We have Representative Perryman. Thank you. Moves to approve the minutes of March 11th, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minute for March 11th, 2026 is approved. And our first bill we're going to consider is House File 4048. Representative Robbins, Chair Robbins, and our goal on this bill is to be done by quarter after. That is our goal, 12 minutes roughly. And Representative Perryman, I understand that you would make a motion to get Representative Robbins' bill before the committee.
I so move.
Thank you. Representative Perryman moves that House File 4048 be recommended to be referred to the Committee of Taxes. We have the bill before us. Representative Robbins, welcome to the committee and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate you hearing this bill. This bill relates to how chiropractors pay the provider tax, but their patients are no longer eligible for benefits. So it's really correcting an injustice for the chiropractors because last year's bill, the governor recommended that they eliminate chiropractic benefit from Medicaid and Medicare, which happened. But the chiropractors themselves are still subject to the tax. So this is important to understand the context. Minnesota is the only state that taxes all 19 provider classes, and it's the only state that taxes chiropractors. Now, that may have made sense when they also got the benefit, but they no longer do. So we're hoping to rectify that with this bill, and I'd like to introduce my testifiers.
Okay, today we have two testifiers. 90 seconds. You will be given a 30-second warning when your time's up. And it looks like we have Dr. Adam Millsop.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. State your name and 90 seconds, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4048. And thank you for Representative Robbins for carrying the bill. My name is Dr. Adam Millsop. I'm Doctor of Chiropractic and the current president of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. Our association serves as a voice of the profession at the Capitol for both our providers and patients. I want to begin by addressing the recent changes to chiropractic coverage under Minnesota healthcare programs. The elimination of this benefit has had a direct impact on both providers and patients. We appreciate Representative Gilman's leadership on House File 3687 and her work to restore this benefit. We continue to engage in those efforts and remain committed to reinstating access for patients. However, the current situation creates a fundamental disconnect. Now, chiropractors are the only providers paying the care tax without reimbursement benefit to provide care for our patients. Nearly all chiropractors in Minnesota are either small business owners or are employed by small business owners. This is a real and immediate concern. How can our providers be expected to take on this tax and administrative costs while losing the ability to help our patients? This is why this bill is necessary. Until the chiropractic benefit is restored, we respectfully request an exemption for chiropractors from the provider tax and welcome your support in restoring access.
Thank you. And next, 90 seconds, Dr. Doug Roman. I hope I have that. You
yes.
are on deck. State your name and
yes,
your 90
thank you.
Seconds.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Doug Roman. I'm a doctor of chiropractic, and I've been serving the citizens of Maple Grove for the past 40 years. I love being a chiropractor. As Dr. Millsup explained, most chiropractors are small business owners with very small staff. The unique challenges of running a small practice are varied and bring with it many financial demands. I have never begrudged paying the provider tax as it provides a vehicle to serve the needs for the most vulnerable in Minnesota. However, it is utterly unfair to be required to pay a tax for services that you are no longer able to provide. Over the past 40 years, I've always accepted Medicaid patients. It's a privilege to serve them, and they are grateful for our service. I encourage the committee to exempt chiropractic from paying this tax as long as we are excluded from providing these services. We are not Mayo Clinic. We are not Fairview. We are not Allina. that we don't have the luxury of an accounting department. Better yet, I would encourage this committee to reinstate the chiropractic services within
30 Medicaid. 30-second warning.
A statistical review of cost analysis by United Health Group with 14.7 million episodes of health care spend determined that chiropractic for low back pain provided excellent results with high patient satisfaction and with the lowest cost of all providers. These patients who do not see us will go elsewhere. They will most likely go to an urgent care or an emergency room facility. These services would be significantly more costly and expose patients to possible medications that are addictive. When you blend red and blue, you get purple. Today I'm wearing a purple tie, and this represents my hope that this committee will do the right thing and pass a bipartisan legislation to correct this misguided policy.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 4048? Okay, seeing none. I am not aware of any amendments. And so further discussion, we have Representative Hewitt. Oh, okay. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious about this. Now, I too am like the doctors and stunned here that they're forced to participate in a program that they're not part of right now. I'm just kind of curious if anybody in the room or any of the testifiers can answer. These programs are based on participation, so those that choose not to do Medicaid or Medicaid patients, if I'm not mistaken, don't they basically don't participate, so they don't benefit from it. How many did participate when you were eligible to? Do we have an approximate number on how many chiropractors actually did the Medicaid care at all?
Representative Robbins, one of the testifiers, any idea?
I do not know, Doctor.
Most, 80%.
Yeah, it's, as far as I'm aware, it is the vast majority of providers, licensed providers in the state, but I don't have that exact answer for you.
Follow up, Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, so that would be, just to clarify, that would be the ones that participated were the vast majority of providers?
Correct, sir.
Okay, and then to the author, I don't like the situation we're in because I know that we're split on this, but I have a bill, House File 97, that I wish we could have just amended into this that would basically reinstate this because it's done then, and then most of the providers. I just think we're determining that people on Medicaid cannot use chiropractic services, and I don't like doing that because healthcare is a science still, and if that works for them, then they should be able to take to use it. So just a quick comment there, but I would like House File 97 to come forward instead of a scrap in the whole program. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm Chair Behrman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I feel just like the Dr. Millsop and Dr. Broman that this benefit should still be there. It was taken away in a year of budget shortfalls, and oftentimes things like that happen. It happened to periodontal care, and for a decade or so or more, we weren't treating people, and the ultimate costs were higher with other providers, and their conditions of patients got worse. So on the one hand, I want, I'm concerned about also changing the provider tax and starting to parse who's actually going to pay it in a way that is going to disrupt and have a line out the door and around the corner as far as who doesn't want to participate in it for whatever reason. Rather than vote for this bill, what I would like to see is that we bring forward the bipartisan bill of Representative Gilman, which exists now. And I think we still have time to do such a bill. And so I'm a no on this bill, but I'm going to be supporting the other direction. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question to the author. When I looked at this, is there anything that says if we do pass either House File 97 or House File 3687, that then this would not be the case. So I understand that, you know, we're saying that these providers shouldn't pay the tax if they're not being able to see the benefits. I don't see anything in here, but I'm wondering if then, if the reverse were true, as Co-Chair Bierman stated, if then we include chiropractic in MA, then this would not apply. Because I have a little bit of a fear that then we're going to say, you don't have to pay it, but then we include it again, and then it's the inverse of what's happening now. So I would love clarification on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Purcell. And to the earlier members who spoke as well, yes. So if we can reinstate the benefit, the chiropractors would be happy to continue paying the provider tax. But if they cannot be reinstated, then they shouldn't have to keep paying the tax. So I'd be happy to take an amendment. I mean, we're grateful to have the hearing and get this still alive, but we continue to have those conversations. We'd be happy to amend our bill, or Representative Gilman could amend her bill with the language. So however we can work that out. They would like to provide care to Medicaid patients. They would like to be reinstated. So, but if that fails to happen, they shouldn't have to pay the tax.
Representative Van Bingsberger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick comment. Thank you, Representative Robbins, for bringing this bill. Depending on what takes place with an amendment, I want to be on the record. You know, I'm thankful for our small businesses, our chiropractors in this state. They run small businesses. We need to do the right thing. Last year we took a benefit away from them, and yet we're still taxing them. So if we're going to continue down that road, we need to do the right thing here, and we need to make sure we remove the tax on our chiropractors in Minnesota. So thank you.
Okay, and then our final questions is from Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing the bill so we can have this discussion, Representative Robbins. So I just have some questions about kind of how this all works. So here are my questions, and I'll just kind of put them out there so you can answer them without going back and forth. But so the first one is just, is the tax only on providers who provide care to MA and Minnesota Care patients, or is it on all providers, just generally, you know, or Does the provider tax apply? So that's my first question. And then the second question, we kind of go back and forth here in our language about whether the tax is being paid by the provider or by the patient. And I know that might be different a little bit with the Medicaid patient, but is the tax paid by patients or is it paid on a per patient basis? So what I'm getting at here is, you know, I'm not commenting on the bill by asking this question, but just as the number of patients drops, I assume that means that the amount of the tax drops too. I know that it doesn't take away the administrative burden, but that's, so those are my questions.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Liebling. So all of them pay the tax regardless of whether they accept or do not accept Medicaid patients. And as for the nuanced accounting, I'm going to turn to my colleagues. So does the tax decline with the volume of patients?
Go ahead. It is based off of all services paid for any type of service rendered to any patient, regardless if they're a cash patient or they are an insurance patient.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so... yeah, so I know we call it the provider tax, and obviously it has to be paid over to the state by providers, but it's really a tax on the patients. And I know a lot of times we call it the sick tax, but it isn't. Mm-hmm. Clearly that's a bit of a misnomer too, but it's really paid by the patients. I just wanted to make sure we're clear about that, although I understand sometimes it's a complicated tax policy. There is no question about that, right? So, but thank you for your help.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, to your bill, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members, for hearing this bill. I think it's an important conversation to have obviously, chiropractors would like to continue to provide this as a benefit to Medicaid patients, but in lieu of that, they should not have to pay a tax when they cannot provide this benefit to their patients. So I encourage support for the bill, and I look forward to continuing to work with Representative Hewitt and Representative Gilman as the session progresses.
Okay. Representative Perryman moves that the House File 4048 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. Okay. Okay, the second bill that we have for considerations, members, is House File 3893. Representative Nadeau, may I have a motion from you to get Representative Chair Scott's bill before the committee?
I move that bill.
There you go. Representative Nadeau moves that House File 3893 be recommended and to be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. We have the bill before us, Representative Scott. Welcome to our committee. Our goal is to do this bill in roughly 15 minutes because we have the some fun other bills behind us. So with that, go ahead, Representative Scott, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I don't think I've ever submitted a bill to or heard a bill in front of the Health Committee, so thanks for having me.
It feels
me.
Good, really doesn't nervous. It, Representative Scott?
I'm really nervous. So
yeah, okay.
Bear with me. No.
Treats? I think this is, where's the treats?
I brought treats for
you. Oh, okay.
I can help you with
that. Okay, there you go. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Representative Scott.
Thank you. Members, there are a lot of bills this session that deal with AI, and this is one of them. I think many of us have seen the very scary and troubling news stories about people that are having chatbots be their best friend and end up taking their own lives and different things. So the Minnesota Psychological Society organization got together this fall and summer and started to try to get ahead of this. So that's what House File 3893 does. And Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead with my intro of the bill, and then should we take up the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Okay,
right.
So what I'm going to do is we have, if you're not against it, we're going to take up that amendment right now.
Okay, we can do the amendment, then I'll do the rest of my intro here.
Oh, okay, let's get the bill in the format that you want. Mm-hmm. We do have an amendment labeled A2. Representative Nadeau, would you like to move that amendment?
I will move the A2.
Representative Nadeau moves the amendment labeled as A2. Representative Scott, please tell us about your amendment.
This amendment is a collaboration of different stakeholders that were involved and just that expressed particular concerns with particular areas of the bill. And so this takes those concerns into consideration. And this also adds in a piece on informed consent.
Okay. Representative Nadeau has moved Amendment A2. Any further discussion on the A2 amendment? Okay, hearing none. Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And you had some more introduction before
yes.
We go to the testifier.
I will move quickly, Mr. Chair. House File 3893 would regulate artificial intelligence from engaging in psychotherapy and counseling with human beings. Legislation has passed in Illinois, Utah, and Colorado. Similar bills are pending in many other states. The U.S. Congress seems to have little bipartisan agreement these days, but they do agree that AI being involved in mental health therapy and counseling is deeply problematic. As I said, a group of Minnesota health professionals, mental health professionals, have been working for many months with legislators to draft a bill that will control the use of artificial intelligence in mental health therapy settings. Therapy should be provided by an educated, trained, and licensed mental health professional, not a chatbot. We have all read the horrifying news stories of people who have committed suicide after being encouraged to do so by the computer they've been talking with. Members, a few of these articles are in your packets. One of those, a recent Wall Street Journal account, talks about a suicide of a 30-year-old man. He was experiencing serious trouble in his marriage and fell in love with his computer. The computer urged him to commit suicide so they could be together digitally. If he had been in the care of an actual human being and therapist, perhaps he would be alive today. Big Tech's answer that their systems are getting better as it learns more are not good enough. AI are supercomputers. They are not human beings who go through many years of education, thousands of hours of training, including supervised therapy, and passing rigorous and comprehensive exams in their field. All mental health professionals licensed to perform psychotherapy have at least a master's degree, and in the case of a psychologist or psychiatrist, a doctorate in psychology or medicine. And then I would like to hand it off now to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Today we have four testifiers, 90 seconds. You will be given a 30-second notice before your 90 seconds is up. And please state your name. We have Dr. Steve
Gibardo.
Thank you. I would not have got that. Go ahead, please. State your name and 90 seconds, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Becker. My name is Dr. Steven Gibardo. I'm a licensed psychologist, been in practice for over three decades now. I am a past president of the American Psychological Association. I've been co-chair of the Legislative Committee for well over a decade. I am the federal advocacy coordinator with APA, and I'm on the Healthcare Advisory Committee for the National Small Business Association. So I know a lot about healthcare. And it is a great concern that AI is moving into the healthcare space. One of the interesting things that I find that's really frightening for me is that everything else in the healthcare space is required to prove that first it does no harm, mm-hmm. and then that it does benefit, that it has actual benefit. Mm-hmm. This is a technology that's trying to move into this space that is not doing that. Are there forms of computer-based interventions that are? Yes, there are some FDA-approved computer-based interventions that are not part of this bill because they're not AI. They're not assessing people. They're not prescribing to people. They're not intervening.
30-second warning.
And so it's not the same. One complaint about the bill is that we don't define things really carefully. We shouldn't have to define things, and if we define specific things, then we're playing whack-a-mole forever. I think that AI and the computer companies, the big computer companies, need to prove no harm and benefit first, and then they should be allowed into the system.
Thank you. We have next is Aaron Miske, and then after that is Nigel Linner. I know I slaughtered that, but go ahead, 90 seconds, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Eric Mishy. I'm the CEO of SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education. We are a 36-year-old Minnesota-based suicide prevention nonprofit organization. We enthusiastically endorse this legislation. We know firsthand from the work that we are doing with parents and children all throughout the country that AI chatbots are, in many cases, a death sentence for far too many people that are using what is really a nascent emerging technology. I want to be very clear. We are not anti-technology. We are not Luddites. But the reality is the big tech companies that have created the social media platforms that we hear all too often that are resulting in children who are dying by suicide as a result of their interaction with these platforms, sextortion, sex trafficking, purchasing illegal drugs, choking games, et cetera, pales in comparison to the harms that AI chatbots can bring upon children as these technologies mimic humans. I want to be clear about something. These are not human entities. These are algorithms. They are machines mimicking as therapists. The reality is that artificial intelligence and chatbots may someday be a powerful tool in suicide prevention, but that future is not yet today. It is not now. We need to have powerful regulation to protect Minnesotans from the harms of these artificial intelligent beings that don't exist. The fact of the matter is that we are at a place where regulation is not simply something that we should look at as a possibility. It's something that people in this state who are struggling need as a reality.
Okay, thank you. And on Zoom, we have Nijah.
Nina Linero.
Okay, we did not pass on that one, so thank you.
No worries.
Okay, you got 90 seconds, and state your name, please, and share us your testimony, please.
Sure. Nina Linero with TechNet. Good afternoon, co-chairs Dacher and Bierman and members of the committee. Again, I am Nina Linero, executive director for TechNet in the Illinois and Midwest. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on House File 3893. TechNet supports thoughtful approaches to regulating artificial intelligence in sensitive settings like psychotherapy. We agree that strong patient protections and maintaining the central role of licensed professionals are critical. We also appreciate Representative Scott's willingness to engage with us on this issue. Our comments focus on ensuring that the bill is clear, workable, and does not unintentionally limit responsible, supervised uses of technology. First, we recommend narrowing the definition of therapeutic communication so it clearly applies to clinical therapy services rather than potentially sweeping in general wellness or educational tools. Second, we suggest clarifying references to emotional distress by focusing more specifically on suicidal or self-harm ideation, providing clearer guidance when safeguards should apply. Third, we encourage revisions to allow AI tools under professional supervision to support administrative functions like tracking patient progress. Without this clarity, the bill may unintentionally restrict tools that help providers deliver consistent care. Finally, we recommend clarifying that AI should not independently determine treatment decisions while still allowing it to assist in drafting routine, professionally reviewed communications. Overall, our goal is to ensure the bill provides clear, actionable standards because ambiguity can create confusion rather than compliance. We've outlined these recommendations in the written testimony submitted to the committee and red lines shared directly with the bill author, and we look forward to continuing our work with Representative Scott and the bill proponents. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Ashley Yost with Woodland.
Hi, I'm Ashley Chose.
Oh, there you go. Zoom. Sorry, go ahead, Ashley.
Okay. I am also a licensed psychologist in the state of Minnesota, and I am the CEO of Woodland Centers. We are a CCBHC serving rural Minnesota. I want to begin by acknowledging that I share the concerns behind this bill. Fully autonomous corporate-developed AI tools that present themselves as mental health providers do pose a real risk. Minnesotans should be protected from unsafe, unregulated AI systems that could cause harm. However, I respectfully urge the committee not to advance House File 3893 as it is written. The bill aims to address large technology companies offering direct-to-consumer AI mental health services, but the regulatory mechanism in this bill does not actually apply to those companies. It creates new requirements for licensed mental health professionals, people like myself who already follow strict ethical, legal, and professional standards. That includes ensuring the tools that we use are safe and that we avoid harm to our clients. And that would include the use of AI. Licensing boards already have authority to investigate and to act on these standards when they are not met by professionals.
30-second warning.
Woodland Centers is a member of MACMIP, MARCH, and MERITAP. And while I am not speaking on behalf of those associations, many of the providers in those associations share the same concerns about the unintended consequences of a bill like this for access in clinical practice. The issues raised in House File 3893 are better addressed through consumer protection and technology policy, not professional licensing statutes. Minnesota has already moved in this direction through legislation like House File 1991 that regulates AI products themselves. So I encourage the committee to consider approaches that more directly target the source of the risk, such as regulating those companies that develop AI mental health tools, prohibiting AI systems from presenting themselves as licensed clinicians, and requiring transparency when somebody is interacting with AI. So these steps would help protect Minnesotans while preserving access to care and supporting our clinicians to use technology responsibly. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Representative Keeler, you have your question next. Oh, I'm sorry, I had to ask if there's testifiers in the audience. My mistake. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3893? Okay. And I'm not aware of any other amendments, correct? No, cool. Okay, so further discussions, we have Representative Keeler. You're first on deck.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. I'm a co-author on this bill. Thank you for spending the time with me over the interim to really learn about this. I guess the first question I have when I was looking through the packet, NAMI doesn't have an opinion on this, whether for or against. Is anybody from NAMI here that we can ask them their take on this bill?
NAMI's been quiet since Sue Abbott left.
It looks like no help there, Representative Keeler.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. They're a huge alliance that focuses on mental health, so if maybe we could see where they stand on this, that would be helpful. I also just want to say suicide prevention is something that is really hard for a lot of us to talk about, so I want to be mindful that we do share the disclaimer that if you or anybody you know is considering this as an option, 988 is a tool that we have, making sure that people know that we have a suicide hotline that we can use as well. But with this, I think a couple things have come up that I just want to like note some things on the record. A lot of people have talked to me about this because they're like, oh, it's so bad for kids. You know, we don't want kids to be a part of this. And I agree. I think, though, too, it's really important to just name a couple things that, one, in the state of Minnesota in 2024, we have data that show that suicide is something that is happening in this state. We know over 800 individuals took their own lives in 2024. 80% of them are male. And so I think that we also need to be really mindful on, in society, how we treat our males, how we raise our sons, to really not lean into supports. We also know that suicide is 2 times as much in the rural communities as it is in the metro. And so we need to make sure that there's, you know, we talk a lot about rural access, mm-hmm. and often people are like, just go to telemedicine. And I worry about that a lot because we can't just say rural access is staying alive because we're going to add computers to do the job. But more than that is that the age range that we're seeing high rates of suicide are age 50 to 54 and 80 to 84. And so making sure that this is the conversation isn't just around protecting our kids, which it obviously needs to be. But there are these other components that we need to just make sure, like, you know, the ombudsperson for aging, you know, are they a part of this conversation? Because it's just a really big population that utilizes these services. And I think some of our elders and our older generation, they don't know how to tell the difference in a chat box, as well as maybe some of our younger generation. And, you know, we see that in fraud and we see that in these other areas. So making sure we're taking the age range and the geographic spread into consideration. I just want to name that. But thank you for doing the work. Thank you for doing the amendment, continuing to listen to advocates as we do this, because I agree we are not at the place that robots should be leaning into helping our most vulnerable populations when they're in a crisis moment. Thank you.
Okay, and our last set of questions on this file is with Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the great conversation here. Really quick, just want to turn to the in our packet, we got a great letter from Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Programs. I think about just in business and in life how AI is helping assist compile notes in meetings, different things like that. So I think there's a couple things in this, and I know that this is a starting point. The one paragraph that really caught my eye, and I just want to ask this question, I don't know who would have this answer, but it says, lastly, it's worth noting that the state and federal privacy laws applicable to behavioral health information prohibit the use of open source or public AI tools. And the Minnesota's licensing boards possess authority to discipline licensees who misuse AI. And it goes into, you know, to more there. So if that authority is already happening, my concern for rural Minnesota and folks like Woodland Centers that are, they're seeing so many people from so many communities and they're using tools to help them but not take the place of a licensed health professional. How can we incorporate that? Like that's big things. And especially I think about rural Minnesota and just mental health, trying to figure out how we can support people who are doing the work. I think of, you know, a doctor who has used to have somebody to help take notes for them, or they would record. They would have a recording device. And now they're doing that with the assistance of AI. So I just want to know, I think as this keeps moving through, we really need to factor in rural folks, folks with, you know, and what are the provisions that we already have under licensure? Thank you.
Comment. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Becker, and thank you for your questions. The amendment actually covers a lot of what you were just talking about, in that it's really looking at trying to allow for what's already there, that there already was transcription services and things like that. The idea is that those transcriptions cannot be the content quality, like pulling out the important bits of information from that, should not be done by the AI. One of the things that I know as a clinician is that when you get a medical record from somebody, you get a record of everything that's in there. And if you're getting a record that literally is a transcription of every session, all of those sessions are meaningless because they don't have a summary. And that summary is a clinician job, not an AI job, because an AI is going to pick things very confidently with not necessarily being accurate. And so we're not saying don't use transcription services, but also if it's going to use passive listening, that's where the informed consent is coming in, where it's letting the patient know that a computer is listening and is transcribing the information, and that information and where that's going to be held and the information security for it. That's the informed consent. As to the bill, we're not just talking about kids. The two examples of suicide we actually talked about were people that were adults and were just as easily kind of talked into it. One of the things that I am seeing, and this is my great honor in my profession, is I am seeing people at their worst moments. And I am trying to help them to navigate their way through those worst moments. Do we really want a program, a computer algorithm, to help somebody through their worst moments because they're not up to it? Mm-hmm. And AI companies saying that they are, they're not being accurate. And I come back to my same point, is they should have to prove a lack of harm and a benefit for what they're trying to do. And one of the things the bill talks about is that AI chatbots should have filters within them to look for, it's clinical words like depression, anxiety, suicide, chemical dependency, and flag them and be required to come forward and say, I am a computer, I am not able to help with this, you need to speak to somebody who's a caring partner in your life or a mental health professional. And that's what we're talking about in trying to get the broader AI. This is not a bill for the licensing boards. Very little of any of this is going to come before a licensing board. It would be if they're using something that integrates the AI or chatbot into determining things and deciding things. That's the only time it would ever come up. It really is putting the onus on the companies to do it.
Okay. Representative Scott, final words before we take a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the good hearing and the good questions. We will continue to take feedback on this and make changes where we think that they can be made. And just want to thank the members again for your time on a really important topic.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nadeau moves that House File 3893 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion does prevail and as amended is recommended to be referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. Next, members, we will have a presentation from MDH. We will hear a presentation from Minnesota Department of Health on 340B. Which is, of course, our favorite topic, one of our favorite topics, just one. And we will do a presentation that will be limited to 10 minutes, and then we will have 10 minutes of questions to the presenters, and then we will take up House File 3609. So our goal is to take up House File 3609 at 2 o'clock. Please state your name. It's Stefan Gilmeiser. I get a point in horseshoes, right?
Good afternoon, Chair Backer.
Go ahead, please.
For
10 minutes.
For the record, my name is Stefan Gilmeiser. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm the state health economist. But apparently I'm not able to bring up the slides because I have limits. I am happy to walk through them. I was in this room an hour ago and it worked. Huh? I think we might be getting there. Mr. Chair, with me...
There we go. We got slides.
Excellent.
All right.
With me is my colleague Annalisa Stieber. She manages our prescription drug policy and research team, and she will cover the bulk of the presentation. In the interest of time, I won't remind you of the role that the Health Economics Program has in supporting you in policymaking, but essentially we're here to monitor the market, to tell you about trends that may be important for your deliberations. Today we're talking about 340B, indeed a topic around which there are many passions. Our focus on this issue is through a report that we issued about a month ago. Quickly, the federal 340B drug pricing program was established to financially support eligible providers' safety net functions. This program works by requiring that drug manufacturers provide a discount on outpatient prescription drug acquisitions. Providers then have the ability to generate revenue or reduce a loss when they provide those drugs for free, because reimbursement is higher than the cost of acquiring the drugs due to the discount. Nationally, policy questions swirl around the growth of the program. It has exploded, some would say, how well it is targeted to entities that provide safety net functions and the financial incentives it generates, and ultimately how these resources come to be used. The Minnesota legislature wanted us to understand, or wanted you to understand, to what extent providers would lose revenue if the state changed how it manages the Medicaid prescription drug benefit. In response to that, we collect the data, we analyze the information, we work with hospitals and FQHCs and clinics to bring in this information, and we summarized it in now the second report. And this is where I pass the mic on to my colleague.
Chair Backer, representatives, hello, I am Annalisa Stieber. I am also from MDH in the Health Economics Program and lead our pharmaceutical work. Very briefly, again, a little bit about the federal 340B program, about what is in scope. It's a federal program that specifies which providers may participate, which prescriptions are eligible specifically for 340B discounts. So it is at the prescription level, it is outpatient drugs. And then there is a formula that sets the acquisition price by which those providers can then purchase the drugs. It does not dictate or influence directly anyways what is the provider is able to get reimbursed for or paid for those drugs. So they are able to essentially buy low and sell high, if you will. Or in some cases, allow some providers to provide medications for free or at a discounted cost and reduce losses. I'm going to skip this for now for the sake of time, but we can come back if it's helpful later. On to the findings from our second report. Who are we talking about in Minnesota? There are a little over 200 providers that participate in the federal 340B program. About half are hospitals and about half are clinics. But the reach of those entities is much greater across the state. They can use outpatient facilities, outpatient clinics, associated sites, and contracted pharmacies to expand which prescriptions apply for the 340B discounts. So this figure shows the net impact in the state. So it's aggregated reporting. We found by reporting that these roughly 200 providers are paying about $1.5 billion for these drugs. That is the discounted cost for the drugs. They have about $165 million in operational costs and then receive about $3 billion for those drugs for a net 340B revenue statewide of $1.34 billion. What's driving that revenue? Again, statewide, was roughly double what we saw in our first year report. This is primarily due to collecting a different scope of the drugs. This year, we believe it was much more complete. Last year, excluded most of the administered drugs. Those are drugs administered by a provider in a clinic setting. Think infusion, think cancer drugs, high-cost drugs that are, again, administered in an outpatient setting by a provider. The increase likely also reflects some growth in the program. We can't see exactly in Minnesota, but nationally, acquisitions under the program have been growing at about 22% year over year. We also see that a lot of that is driven by specialty drugs, and a lot of that is coming from the hospitals, about 80% of those net revenues. There's a lot here going on the table, but I would just want to bring your attention to the last column to show that there's significant variety between the different providers that participate in 340B in this state. You can see five major groupings that we use throughout the report. The top two rows are hospitals, and the final column is the average net revenue per entity within that grouping. And you can see that the general acute care hospitals are making nearly $50 million in net revenue, whereas if you go to the bottom rows, some of the clinics are maybe half a million for a year. Other things from the report, most of the net 340B revenue is generated from patients that are covered by commercial plans or Medicare. That's about 80% of that statewide net revenue. Also, for every $100 in gross revenue, so that's when we're not accounting for the costs of operating the program, about $10 goes to external organizations. That's fees to contract pharmacies, largely third-party administrators, for a total of $137 million in the state going to intermediaries, about $28 million internally. And then again, to reiterate, the cost varied varied significantly. So when you're just looking at the costs, different entities spent different amounts of their net revenue or relative to their net revenue on operating costs. Also in the report, we go take a deeper dive into drug level findings, the policy landscape, and entity level net 340B revenue. This is statutorily required, and you can see some of that here. Amongst all of the statewide net 340B revenue, 90% came from 25 covered entities. Those are all listed in the report. 8 of them are shown here, and all but one are hospitals. In conclusion, one of the takeaways perhaps for today is that the 340B program is an example of complexity in the healthcare system. There has been limited transparency. The complexity of the program requires significant administrative investment by the organizations. And once established, the program develops a dynamic of its own, becoming a commercial opportunity, particularly for intermediaries or middlemen. Minnesota's initiative here, created by all of you, has created a lot of momentum nationwide. There are now over a dozen states that have passed legislation to try and get a better understanding of 340B and the role it plays in their community. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to take any questions.
Okay, folks. Members, we'll take questions up to 2 o'clock. We don't have to take all that time, but at the same time, if there's questions, we have no one on the list right now for questions. Whoa, look at that. Representative Hewitt was first on the line, so... Representative Hewitt, go, and then Elkins after that. Go ahead. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I don't know if I got this right or not, but when you say non-hospital entities or something in the handout you gave us, does that include, like, assisted living, nursing homes, things like that? Can they get into these programs?
Chair, Representative.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Those are... what we would call a safety net or grantee clinics, primarily STD clinics, hemophilia care sites, There's about a dozen different types of CARES. It is not, as far as that I can think of, any kind of assisted living or that sort of setting.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number that really jumps off at everybody who reads the report, and I've read the whole report, it's fascinating, but on page, I think it would be, page 12, yep. Page 12 shows the list, the top recipients in order. Am I correct in surmising that that mHealth Fairview and Abbott are jumping out at the top that because they're probably doing a lot of cancer infusions? Does the underlying data support that hypothesis?
Go ahead, please.
Chair, Representative Elkins, thank you. We have, I can't say exactly what these programs are doing to generate that revenue, but we do see at large a lot of revenue being generated from those high cost drugs, specialty drugs, although there's not a great definition for those. Cancer treatments would certainly fall in that category.
Yeah.
And provide a, you would say, opportunity to generate quite a bit of 340B revenue.
Yeah, thank you. The point being, Mr. Chair, that when we think of a 340B entity as probably originally envisioned, it would be a small, community clinic, things like that. And those kinds of facilities just don't do oncology infusions. And so I think this is why, it's what we're seeing at the top of this list are facilities, large facilities that are equipped to deliver very expensive infused drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
After just a comment, my question, and Representative Gilman. So basically, the first year report really focused on the dispensary drugs. Then year two, it went to also administrative drugs, and like Representative Elkin talks about, we get into some of those special care drugs that are not cheap. So that's okay. You're nodding your head. Okay, Representative Gilman, you have the floor. And then after that, we have Chair Bierman.
Thank you so much, Chair. I'd just like to piggyback off this. So what extent do the revenues reach patient populations? Like which communities benefit the most that you found in your report? Is that?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, the study authorizing language directed us to focus on higher level kind of questions. So we don't ultimately know to what extent how these revenues are being used by the hospitals. The federal statutes also are not particularly prescriptive. Essentially, they set the framework and they recognize presumably that resources are fungible, and how these resources are used ultimately might vary from facility to facility, but we don't know what that currently looks like.
Follow up, Representative Gilman?
I'm going to wait. Thank you.
Okay. What I'd like to do, we have Chair Bierman, Vice Chair Nadeau, and then get into the bill. I want to be very respectful to the two co-authors. So Representative Bierman and then Representative Nadeau will be our final questions for the presenters, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. But first, I did want to just note that I believe it was Chair Liebling who started off all of this reporting and is now sort of spreading across the country. So kudos to you for beginning it and getting us the detail. And thank you to the department for being able to do reports and inform us, because there's a lot of work to do on this 340B going forward. Question I had is on the reimbursements that hospitals claim or get. Do you track all of those, and especially ones that, maybe a hospital has procured pharmaceuticals, but they're not getting reimbursements from pharmaceuticals? Do you track that as well or not?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Chair Rehman, I think your question was, besides giving Representative Liebling kudos, and I can't tell you how many states have reached out and asked How did you do that? How do you collect the data? So and definitely Minnesota is leading there. To your question, do we track reimbursements? I think there are technical ways in existing claims data to approximate which drug may be a 340B drug. But I would say it's probably more of an estimate, and we haven't done that yet analytically, and it was not part of the study. I would say the practice that we are aware of is that the payer, whether this is a patient or a managed care organization or a health plan company, does not know to what extent a drug was acquired at a discount or not. They would just pay the contractual rates that were negotiated, whether those are for Medicare Advantage, commercial, or self-pay.
Thank you.
Okay. Vice Chair Nadeau, our final questions here before we get to the bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And in the report, there was a couple of changes between the first report and the second report. And number one, so my first question is, the initial report had TPA, third-party administrators, and contracted pharmacies as about 16%. The new report kind of identifies it as other, I think it was other business expenses or something, and then indicates it at about 12%. And then, so that's, I want you to talk about why there's a differentiation here. And the second part of my question is, in the language of the report, it talked about how these operational costs, these internal costs, I don't remember, it was inflated. Internal costs should be used with caution, as these indicators show it's possible internal costs are inflated, resulting in deflated net 340B revenue. Can you talk about how you came to that assumption as well?
Go ahead, please.
Sure, Chair, Vice Chair Nadeau, thank you. To your first question, there was some difference in the legislation between the first and second year, specifically as it relates to the administrative costs. In the first year, if I recall, the external entity costs that are not a contract pharmacy, so this is essentially TPAs or third-party administrators, was an optional field and was not required. And so the percents that you referenced would be different because of the reporting on those fields in particular and how they relate to that total number, which obviously got bigger in the second year. And so we believe that the reporting in the second year was much more complete and gives a much better picture of those costs for all of these entities. To your second question about the internal costs, I believe we detail this in one of the appendices, but there was a lot of inconsistency in how that the entities reported on that field. And in some instances, we don't know what was included. Sometimes the reporting entities indicated things that would be outside of scope generally for what would be an internal cost related to operating the 340B program. They included general operating costs and not ones particular to 340B, but our ability to really get at what was included in that was poor, and so that is the reason for our kind of caution in how we would use that figure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the presenters. One quick question, then Chair leaving.
Yeah, thank you. Not so much a question, but I just wanted to say, first of all, you know, thank you to MDH and particularly the presenters we have here today, because this has really been a lot of work. This is, you know, passing legislation is just, you know, this just starts the ball rolling, and it's been a lot of work to put this together. And as they mentioned, this is a nation-leading thing, that we even begin to understand this program. We never knew what the program was, because it wasn't something that Minnesota legislators ever thought influenced us or had any impact here, or we just wouldn't have known about it because it's a federal program. So but I do think one lesson we really should draw from this is how complicated our system is and how much is going on behind the scenes and how little we as legislators understand. When a hospital comes to us and says, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, having difficulty, we have very little way to really evaluate that. Mm-hmm. And the same is true with a lot of, and I'm, you know, not blaming anybody here, but just saying our tools are very limited to how do we really evaluate what the income streams are and what the outgoes are. So I think this is just a really good illustration of how much is going on behind the scenes, you know, for good or for ill, and we may not be able to impact it, we may not want to, but just to understand the complexity of the thing and to have a little understanding that we don't know a lot of things. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, MDO. 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, Chair Liebling, just want to be sure you know you can call on us if you're looking into questions on the complexity of the healthcare market. It's our job. We try to do it well. We're oftentimes overwhelmed ourselves, but we can certainly help the committee bring more evidence to the table as you weigh really difficult decisions.
Okay, thank you. So the third bill that we have for consideration today is House File 3609. Again, we appreciate the presentation from MDH. And as the co-authors are moving up, and Representative Zalisicard, would you like to move House File 3609 to get it before the committee? Representative, you like to move this?
Yes, Chair Backer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Zalesicard moves that House File 3609 be recommended and referred to the Committee of Commerce, Finance, and Policy. We have the bill in front of us. Tell us about your bill, please. And we have co-authors, so we have Chair. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members. I don't think there could be a more complicated bill to present today, but I'm going to give it my best. In 1992, Congress created 340B, and the law states that the drug manufacturers must agree to make covered outpatient drugs available. So in 2010, Congress expanded the 340B to critical access hospitals, sole community hospitals, disproportionate medical assistance share hospitals, rural referral centers, cancer centers, and expanded the eligibility for covered entities to use more than one pharmacy, more than one contract pharmacy. In 2024, the Minnesota legislature passed a law that prohibits pharmaceutical manufacturers from imposing restrictions on delivering 340B meds to contract pharmacy. While it was not heard in committee, it passed in the cannabis omnibus bill in 2024. Since then, there have been issues for the last 2 years with pharmaceutical manager. The issue has been that this has been questioned, and there has been court cases between in the state and federal systems. Minnesota law has been upheld, but there's been a continued situation of controversy regarding honoring these 340B pricing. With that said, I understand how complex this issue is. The room is packed. What my intent is to make sure that the entire state has a model that's protected in the sense that we are in a situation where hospital margins tend to be 1% to 2%. We have all different kinds of hospitals, as I listed off. And one thing I do know is that if there's not a good plan for an alternative to the federal program that exists today, as I just defined, then what is the plan? Without it, we may have a spoke pulled out that could wobble the state wheel of hospital-delivered care in the varieties that it is, and that concerns me. So the bill... Chair Backer, would you like me to present what the original bill?
What we would like to do is, did the co-chair have any comments? We can give it to 90 seconds. Then we're going to go to the DE amendment, the two different amendments next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representatives Lesnikar and members. I'll reiterate that House File 3609 is about answering one simple question. Are we going to stand with Minnesota patients, or are we going to allow corporate drug manufacturers to decide who gets care in our state? It's an easy question with a clear answer, but what else is clear is that I know that through my work of fighting against Big Pharma, that the drug companies continue to make the same choices over and over again. They choose profit over people and act as if they're above the law. When it came to regulating the opioid crisis that created an addiction epidemic and, entrapped my own family in it, they fought it, litigated it, and they lost. And when it came to the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act, again, they fought it, litigated it, and lost. When it came to establishing drug price transparency, again, fought it, litigated, and lost. And when it comes to 340B and its critical support of patients' access to care, they will always fight it, they will always litigate it, they will always choose profit over people, and will continue to lose at the state and federal levels. But their usual behavior is not the full story of 340B. Before us today, their fight is over patient access and the use of the 340B contract pharmacies started in June 2020. In the middle of the pandemic, when hospitals and other safety nets were pushed to the max, drug manufacturers sent out letters saying that they were done, just done. They used the time of maximum chaos and global pandemic as their appropriate time to add even more uncertainty to the fray, putting more stress on the safety net because they could and saw the opportunity. So again, the question before us is, which will we choose? More from the same old drug companies or keeping our vital sources of support and patient access to care strong as possible in Minnesota? I support House File 3609 as is and choose access to care for patients. I don't often come before this committee, and so I just wanted to take the opportunity to say hi to all you fine folks. And then I did serve one term on Health and Human Services when Representative Schumacher was my chair and was a wonderful chair. Very funny. Well, I don't know about that. But this is very important. We want to make sure that our hospitals are able to care for our community. Remember, these hospitals are community hospitals. They take care of the people in our communities, and we want to make sure that they're there for us. And if one goes, it's going to be a really, really bad situation for everybody. So, with that, I will.
Okay.
You
well,
to your business. So.
Thank you. Well, we had alumni moment there, so thank you so much for that. So, appreciate that. Yes. We do have a amendment labeled DE1. Representative Zalesicard, would you like to move that amendment?
Yes.
Okay. And Representative Zalesicard moves the amendment labeled DE1. Tell us about the amendment, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members. This gets the bill in a format. We have deadlines next week. We just heard the report from the Minnesota Department of Health. So the amendment just puts this bill in a format to not sunset 340B and address that horse, the elephant in the room, to get that taken care of. That remains. So that we take care of making sure 340B can exist in the form it was meant to be. And then the secondary piece on there is to continue what we have done in the report that was presented to us, to continue some form of reporting. And I understand there could be some amendments that have to be made for this bill to move to commerce on that topic, but that's why I added that part in, because I didn't have knowledge that this report would be out. It came out at the end of February. It felt like that's the right thing to do, to have some form of a way. I honestly think that we need some sort of a bipartisan task force similar to what we did with ambulance task force. This issue is very complicated, but I put that in there. And then the piece that I removed is the piece we haven't had, so that this bill is in the format to have a chance to hit deadline of the new the provision to have sanction. Well, I understand the intent of it. I think this year the pieces we need to get the horse done, which is the two pieces of that I talked about, which is preserve 340B, deal with the other things as we continue to move forward in the sense of the scope of reporting and then what we want to do with regulatory compliance as other states are starting to do this. I researched it a lot, and there's variations of it, and members need to be abreast of all of it. So that is why this is in the place to get this, to keep this moving in conversation, and that is why we have the DE amendment.
Okay. Discussion on the amendment. We have Chair Liebling. Our goal, and then, okay, I'm sorry. It's okay, you're on there. But we'll have Chair Liebling go first, and then our goal is to try to vote on the amendment by 20 after. Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Has there been a fiscal note requested on this amendment? Because it just occurs to me that you're asking the Department of Health to do a bunch of new analysis for which they may or may not actually have data, and it could cost extra money.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Backer and Representative Liebling. You're 100% correct. So when I say that, yes, there would have to be a fiscal note on that, I believe that the reporting had a note in the Health and Human Services budget for the scope of this report. So that would be, we'd have to have a conversation on that if it goes to Commerce, which is what would I would recommend. And I understand that. We'd have to get a fiscal note on that piece if it is. And so those are the pieces. But the piece of making sure that we deal with preserving 340B is essential.
Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for bringing the bill forward. I like the House File 3609 far better than this iteration. This DE1 does not really support our hospitals the same way. And I just am wondering who you worked with for this iteration and the changes that you made.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. You know, right now, the bill is to not have 340B sunset. That stays the same. And address the fact of the reporting that's in here that we got today, and to not add the sanction piece until the further conversations happen as we go forward. So that is the gist of getting this in lined up. We have deadlines in a week from Friday, and we are not going to be meeting in the next 2 days. So trying to have this bill move forward in the best way possible, knowing what we're up against in a session with 3 months.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. So I agree with the reporting, the added reporting. I think that is something that we want to have. But the bill is, in my opinion, when you don't have the enforcement, that is kind of the crux of the problem. And this has taken that out. And I understand 340B is a very complicated program, and I think there's ways that we as a state could revamp and restructure as a state is able to change and design the 340B program somewhat as a state. But the crux of the problem is the enforcement piece, and taking that out really is not beneficial to our providers, and I think it's something that we need to keep. I don't support this bill in its current iteration. If it's a DE1, I will be a no vote on this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
So you're asking for a roll call on the DE1 amendment. Is that correct? Okay. Roll call has been called. Go ahead, Representative Zalesnikar. Did you have any comment?
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Bierman. This is an incredibly complicated bill. Anybody that's worked in healthcare understands it's incredibly complicated. I have looked at, there are several states that are just starting to do sanctions and penalties. The federal government has always had the jurisdiction of this program. And so there's many formats that should be analyzed, and I believe in a bipartisan way, like we did the ambulance task force. But to put things in right now and to have that be that's a whole other element to have a lot of conversation on when we are in the position of timing right now at our legislative session in a short session to get all of these things to move in a way. I don't disagree with you that we have to do something. I'm very committed to doing something and to working together for the best plan for that. But I believe that we need to have a format that is reasonable, that is, and many, many people have to be educated on all the complexities of this, and there is tremendous learning curve for regardless of which side of the aisle you are on and how you understand this, because it is not something you can just understand in a committee briefing. It is incredibly complicated with a lot of various spokes in the wheel that when you do one thing, it's going to have six other implications. And I think we need to do due diligence on that part. I also understand what Representative Liebling saying, that there could be a cost to reporting, and we have to find that out too. But I'm not saying that those other pieces don't have to be analyzed. I am committed to further work on it, to even do some more amendments. But my suggestion would to be to continue this conversation, to move this to Commerce, and I am more than willing to work with both sides of the topic to try to accomplish that thing so that we, 340B sunsets as is in 2027. I am trying to allow us to have the best pathway to get the horse accomplished here, to not have that happen, and fully knowing we have reporting issues and penalty issues that can be further discussed as we move through. This isn't the end of the conversation. I would say it's the beginning, and I would suggest that we probably need a task force. I can't get all those things accomplished like that. It's going to take a process of conversations to do this the right way, not just in a time frame that doesn't make sense when we don't have the I's dotted and the T's crossed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to be taking a vote on the DE by 20 after. I have Vice Chair Ryer and Vice Chair Nadeau, and then we're going to take a vote. Unless we go past, we're going to take a vote at 20 after. Go ahead,
you.
Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Thank you to both of the presenters on this. I'm in a real middle position on this because I was encouraged to see that we had enforcement, because I do think that many of us have spent a lot of time thinking about 340B. It's not our first 340B rodeo, so to speak. Also, the companies have had plenty of time to know what they should be doing. And so it's not like enforcement is coming on a new program that no one's ever seen. So I'm very disappointed to see that go away. On the other hand, in your DE, I really liked the additional reporting because it takes us another level. I would recommend withdrawing the DE and making those changes in to add the other reporting when you take it to Commerce. Take it as it is, bring it the next level. I won't be able to vote for the DE because I think the enforcement's important, but I hate to walk away from the other parts. So I hope you'll consider doing a new iteration of the amendment. Thank you.
And finally, Representative Nadeau, Vice Chair Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is, I think that this is a pretty good middle ground, actually, Representative Zeleznikar, because the AG, their job is to protect consumer. They have consumer protection laws. They already have the ability to bring action under the unfair and deceptive trade practices. So, I mean, that's already there. So Representative Bierman, I don't know if that is a good enough reason not to vote for it. What this DE does is it basically starts doing the things that the State Attorney General's office needs in order to move against a bad actor, and that's when a provider misrepresents 340B spending. And we don't have that information. And so I think that's what is in the reporting component of the DE-1. It's moving in that direction. that gives the legal status for AG to actually do its job. And we know that if the AG language stays in it as is, they're going to come back and say that we need more money. You know, we need money to do this. And so I think it's a masterful way to actually start building that case for the AG to be able to do the work against bad actors in the 340B program. So thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. I'm a yes vote on this DE1.
Okay, vote. Members, we are going to have, with roll call being called, we will take a vote. This is on the amendment labeled DE1. Again, amendment labeled DE1. Go ahead.
Chair Backer?
Yes.
Chair Bierman?
No.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ryer?
No.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative DePell?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Franson? Representative Franson?
Franson votes yes.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knudsen?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud? Representative Perryman?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rapinski?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Van Spigenbergen?
Yes.
Representative Zalesnikar?
Aye.
The motion is 11-11. It does not prevail. Okay, next on our docket is we have an amendment labeled A4. Representative Schumacher, would you like to move that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A4 amendment.
And please tell us about your amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as we start out the conversation with this, I am a co-author on the original 3609 bill. And I, Representative Zalesnikar had said, I got onto this bill before I got to see the report. And since that report came out, there's been a few thoughts to some changes and updates that could be made to what we're doing here. And the repealer piece, it's another thing that's just good to note, is that it's not repealing the 340B program that we're dealing with here. It's the limit that manufacturers can put on the number of contracts that a hospital can have that is the repealer piece. And that's part of what makes this so confusing, is because we have this, and for a couple of years it felt like double negatives that we were dealing with on repealing stuff that wasn't going to happen. And I think I'm starting to understand it now. Great time to leave. But I will leave with this, hopefully, as part of what comes through. And so what this amendment is attempting to do is to provide for claims-level data on outpatient interactions to happen and to have that limited within. It specifically outlines the entities that can be used in this to, and that they can't be used for reimbursement or imposing fees, and so it shouldn't cost providers anymore to offer this. And then the biggest thing here is that it prohibits the contracts with out-of-state pharmacies, because that was, to get that in the report, and we heard it in the presentation today, 50% of the pharmacies that are being used are out-of-state. Even coming from a border community like I do, and a lot of the care that my constituents get are from out-of-state, that seems counterintuitive to the entire program and what we're trying to do with the 340B. And so I submit the A4 amendment for the committee's consideration.
Okay. Representative Schumacher has moved amendment A4. Any further discussion on A4? Chair Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Schumacher, so when you understand things, you should stay. First of all, I can get that out of the way.
I agree.
But I just wanted to ask you to explain a little more why you think it doesn't fit with the program to use out-of-state contract pharmacies, because the, you know, I mean, it is a national program. I just don't really understand why you view that as not a good thing, other than wanting to maybe limit the amount of money that comes to the covered entities. That is what the effect would be, I think. So if you could explain.
Go ahead, Chair Schumacher.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling on this. Yes, you're right. It's a national program. From that perspective, it should benefit all. I was looking at it more from the perspective of when I hear from my local pharmacists, of those who are left, and the ones who are benefiting from this program, they would benefit more if we weren't allowing for the out-of-state to be taking part in that they had to do their contracts with pharmacies in-state with that. And so that was my thought with that, is that it would benefit our local folks more. And I have a feeling I know how Representative Liebling is thinking at the moment, and it's specifically for this at this moment, not into other areas of any other parts of healthcare.
Well, we have a chuckling going on here. Good. Good to see. Follow-up, Chair. Any follow-up?
No.
Okay, so in time, we'll take one last question from Chair Bierman and then vote on Ryer. Oh, I'm sorry. Then we've got to get to vote on this to get to testifiers. Go ahead, Chair Bierman, then Anuep with Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm also concerned about the out-of-state pharmacy requirements. You know, our drug chain is very broad, and certain things in specialty pharmacy, well, that's other, but there's still a lot of drugs that they're out of country, many of them. So I think having that limitation at this time until we do that deeper dive is would not be prudent. I'm also concerned about the requesting of additional information from manufacturers to covered entities, and I worry from being in hospitals and talking to administrators about the level of correspondence and checking back and post business dealings with insurers and pharmaceuticals, that they could be under a swamp of information, sort of like a prior authorization, and I'm just concerned about that limit or limiting that. And then just the privacy of the data. I would want that to be further addressed as well. So not on board on the A4. Thank you.
Okay. And finally, Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Schumacher, my question was one that is just a little more specific than Chair Bierman, and that is whether we have a sense of how many different drugs or products would not be available if we had the out-of-state limitation, because clearly we wouldn't want people to be left without their needed products.
Go ahead, Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Ryer. I don't have an answer for you on that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call too, please.
A roll call vote has been called. Okay, we will take a roll call. Go ahead.
Chair Backer?
Aye.
Chair Bierman?
No.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ryer?
No.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative DePell?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Franson?
Aye.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knutson?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Perryman?
Aye.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rapinski?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Van Binsbergen?
Aye.
Representative Zelenskar.
Aye.
We have 11-11. I suspect if my... Good. Due to the tie, the motion does not prevail. Okay, we have testifiers. Today, we have seven testifiers for House File 3609. There's written in your package. Each testifier will be given 90 seconds. First on deck is Greg Ruberg, and then Rochelle Schultz, and then after that, Rachel Schultz, and then Rochelle Westland. So state your name, 90 seconds, we will be strict.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Ruberg. I'm the president of Aspirus Lakeview Hospital in Two Harbors, vice president of St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth, and the board chair of the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here in strong support of House File 3609. First, thank you to Representative Zelenskar for your leadership on this bill and continued support of Minnesota's safety net providers and the patients we serve. I also want to thank Representative Cagle for bringing a bipartisan focus to this central issue, access to care for Minnesotans and not protecting the actions of international drug companies that violate state law. As chair of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing 140 hospitals and health systems across the state, our story is not unique. Across Minnesota, hospitals and health systems rely on 340B to sustain services, support patients, and maintain access in communities, both large and small. The 340B program allows us to stretch scarce federal resources and reinvest in services that would otherwise be at risk. This program is critical for our hospitals and the patients we serve. I want to highlight two examples of how Aspirus Lakeview utilizes this benefit of the
30-second warning. Program.
We don't have a pharmacy open past 6 p.m. during the week and nothing open on Sundays. We use 340B savings to subsidize a pharmacy vending machine in our waiting room in our emergency department. Without this, patients would drive 30 to 45 minutes out of the county for access to prescriptions or not to live at all. In addition, our hospital partners with our local public health agency and local school district to financially support a mental health counselor in the schools. This is possible because of 340B savings. Minnesota hospitals take seriously our responsibility to use every available resource.
Please wrap it up.
Deliver high quality care. I would encourage all of you to support House File 3609. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Rochelle Schultz, and then Rachel Schultz, then Rochelle Westland, and then Jessica Lynch. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rochelle Schultz, and I am the serve as the president and CEO of Winona Health in Winona, Minnesota. And I'm here on behalf of the patients and communities who rely on us for care and in strong support of House File 3609. Winona Health is a 49-bed rural hospital with related services. Our size, location, and service lines make us a critical part of Minnesota's rural and state healthcare system, and our patients rely on us every single day. Over 65% of our revenue comes from government plans, and these plans reimburse us less than the cost of providing care, and that differential continues to grow without options to cover it. In our last fiscal year, 25, we had an operating loss of $9 million, a financial challenge that we continue to slowly improve. A key financial hurdle is the increasing cost of drugs and the 340B restrictions the pharmacy companies put in place. Winona Health qualifies for the 340B program through a formula based on our Medicaid inpatient days, and it is not a guarantee that we will have that program year after year. We do use the program exactly as intended to sustain access to care when other sources of support can't or won't. Simply put, we could not afford the medications
or patients second need warning.
Without 340B. Just to give you an idea of the impact on Winona Health and our patients, over the four-year period, fiscal year 22 to 26, our total drug expense increased from $10.9 million to $14.3, a 31% increase. At the same time, 340B, which helps offset our drug costs, is still below fiscal year 22 levels, at 13% lower than fiscal year 22. It's important to know that this is a critical part of ensuring access to care, and we provide labor, continue to provide labor and delivery services in a rural community where much of that is disappearing, as well as mental health services across the continuum.
Wrap up, please.
Thank you. So I, too, would encourage your support of House File 3609.
Okay. We have Rochelle Westland. After that, Jessica Lynch, and then Geneva Plumdoor. So Rochelle Westland.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rochelle Westland, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. Thank you for the opportunity today to support House File 3609. MNAC represents the 17 federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs, providing medical, dental, and behavioral health care in medically underserved areas statewide. FQHCs are covered entities under the 340B program. We're a very small but very important part of that program. For FQHCs, about 80% of our patients are either Medicaid or uninsured, which means we don't get reimbursement for 340B dollars. But because our clinics are small and most cannot afford to have an in-house pharmacy, we are heavily relying on contract pharmacies to make sure our patients can get the drugs that they need. Before the prohibition on contract pharmacies, some manufacturers said that health centers could only have one contract pharmacy per clinic. That would mean that if a clinic had multiple locations, like our Scenic Rivers clinic that is operating
warning.
A space larger than the state of New Jersey, somebody that got a prescription in one clinic in Big Fork would have to drive 70 miles to get their prescription in Floodwood or not get that discounted patient or discounted drug or get that care. Our patients already face significant barriers to care, including access to transportation. And so access to local pharmacy is really critical for our patients to make sure that they are getting the services that they need. And this is the bedrock of the 340B program. Thank you for your time, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Okay. Jessica, you're on, and then Geneva, and then Emily. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Backer and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Lynch, and I'm with Forma. I'm here in respectful opposition to House File 3609. I want to first begin by saying that Pharma strongly supports the original intent of the 340B program, which was to ensure that vulnerable and low-income patients could access their medicines. But the state's own 340B covered entity report paints a different picture of the program, one that now shows that large tax-exempt hospitals and for-profit entities like PBMs and TPAs are profiting off the program instead. Pharma is concerned that 340B savings aren't being shared with patients. Only 3 to 4% of patients see 340B savings at the pharmacy counter, and House File 3609 contains no requirement to pass reduced savings or pricings on to patients. In fact, this bill does not directly impact patients at all in any clear or comprehensive way. Instead, House File 3609 expands contract pharmacy reach. But a pharmacy's status as a contract pharmacy has no impact on whether or not a patient can pick up their medicines
warning.
From the pharmacy. There is not an access issue here. Ultimately, House File 3609 is premature. With the July 2027 sunset date, no action is required of the legislature this year, and it is our position that no action is required at all. The 340B program is not and will not go away in Minnesota. 340B is a federal program, and state legislators do not need to act to ensure that 340B continues in the state. Manufacturers will continue to ship 340B reduced price drugs to hospitals and safety net clinics. The sunset provision allows you to give time to reflect and think on this for another year. Thank you.
Okay, Geneva, and then Emily, then go ahead. Yes.
Hi.
There you are.
Hi,
okay.
Hello. Hi, Representative Backer and members of the committee. Genevieve Plumidor, I'm here representing Bristol-Myers Squibb, or BMS, a pharmaceutical company. In Minnesota, we have 138 employees working remotely throughout the state, supporting some of the most advanced therapies in medicine today. My full testimony is in your packets, but I did want to give you our perspective. The federal 340B program was established in 1982 as a modest program to help support providers known as covered entities. It is now the second largest drug program after Medicare Part D. And this program's growth has been explosive and does not reflect patient benefit. We have seen this firsthand. In 2025, BMS paid more than $135 million in 340B discounts in Minnesota alone. This is an increase of more than 18% when compared to 2024. Only 2% of those discounts were extended to grantees, while 98% went to large hospital systems. And these figures are consistent with what was in the report that you heard today. Minnesota does not need to act. Now that the second most more comprehensive transparency report has been published, you can now consider targeted solutions to ensure that 340B discounts go to the patients that the program was intended to serve. Again, as a reminder, if you do nothing today, nothing happens to the 340B program. It will not go away. It is a federal program. And BMS has participated in the 340B program since its inception in 1992, and we will continue to support the goal of helping vulnerable patients receive their medicines. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Thank you. Emily, and then after Emily is Kyle. So go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Emily Jabalina, and I'm the Director of State Government Affairs at AbbVie, a global biopharmaceutical company headquartered in Illinois with more than 100 employees in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify in opposition to House File 3609. Given our time constraints today, I wanted to focus on just one example that AbbVie sees of 340B financial incentives driving prescribing patterns. Let's take AbbVie's drug Humira, for example. Humira went off patent in 2023, allowing for the introduction of biosimilars on the market. There are now 10 biosimilars on the market, some of which being offered at discounts exceeding 85% of the cost of Humira. As a result, in non-340B hospitals and clinics, we have seen a significant decrease in Humira sales across the country. As such, you would expect that we would see a similar pattern in 340B covered entities. However, with 340B covered entities in Minnesota, our Humira sales have continued to grow. For example, one Minnesota hospital's 340B Humira purchases increased from $18 million in 2022 to $50 million in 2025. Why is this? Because 340B hospitals and clinics make more money on Humira than biosimilars, creating a financial incentive for them to continue to prescribe the more expensive drug. This incentive was also noted in the Minnesota Transparency Report that we heard about today. Removing the sunset provision from Minnesota's 340B contract pharmacy mandate perpetuates the continued unsustainable growth of the 340B program. I would encourage continued discussions on this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, and appreciate it. Kyle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kyle Makarios. I'm here on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Industry Labor Management Association. In your packets, you have a letter from us that is signed by five Minnesota unions opposing this bill: the Minnesota Pipe Trades, the IBW State Council, the Operating Engineers Local 49, the Sheet Metal Workers Local 10, and the Heat and Frost Insulators Local 34. While we support the original intent of federal 340B law, we are opposed to state laws that seek to squeeze more money out of the system to benefit one entity in a complicated, intertwined healthcare system. That squeeze is not simply a tug of war between hospitals and pharmaceutical companies. It's more like squeezing a balloon that shifts costs throughout the system, including onto union members and private payers. In your packets, you'll also find a summary of a study that we recently conducted that shows that 340B drives up drug costs for our union healthcare plans by nearly 5%. That's because when hospitals buy drugs at pennies on the dollar and mark them up, they're not just selling those drugs to uninsured patients or patients on Medicaid. They also sell them to fully privately insured union members. But our union benefit funds negotiate our own drug discounts through pharmacy benefit managers. When a union member goes to a 340B hospital, they pay the marked up rate for that drug that it is not eligible for our rebate. How can we expect a pharmaceutical company to give us a rebate on a drug they've already sold to a hospital at pennies on the dollar? The Minnesota 340B law has exacerbated this market distortion and is driving up drug costs for our members. I don't have a study to prove it, but I strongly suspect that it is having a similar impact on private employer-sponsored plans and public employee plans as well. This is a federal program. We should let the sunset expire on the Minnesota law and leave Congress to iron out the differences. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, testifiers. Representative Lissacard withdraws her motion. House File 3609 will be laid over to be worked on. The meeting is
Mr. Chair.
Meeting's adjourned.